I think you should rename it, not your ideal client. I think you should name it as a client who has the potential to give you money.
Jack?
Yeah.
Joe
your
Money.
Jack client.
Joe Money.
Where do we start this? An answer doesn't matter. We're having a good time. Right.
He couldn't wait to get in here.
You need sales balls to make sales calls.
I'm tweeting that puppy.
Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Sell or Die podcast, the global premier personal development and sales podcast on the planet. My name is Jeffrey Gittimer, author of The Little Red Book of Selling and my newest book, The Sales Manifesto.
And I'm Jen Gluckow, author of Sales in a New York Minute. We are interviewing leaders in business, sales, and personal development to give you the strategies it takes to make more sales and make more money.
Strategies that you can take out into the street and turn into money 1 minute after you hear them.
In a manifesto moment?
Well, no, more like in a New York Minute.
Oh, thank you to all the diehards out there supporting us with listens and 5-star reviews.
Be a star on Sell or Die. Leave your own review. Come on. Go to your computer right now. Go to iTunes right now and write down, type down, talk down exactly how you feel about this podcast and how it might affect others.
All right. I want you to enjoy today's show. Take notes and tell us what you think on our Sell or Die Hard official Facebook group.
All right, let's get to it. It's time to sell or die. So Michael Sapersky is the CEO of Consulting Success and coach to consultants. Here's a man who has advised organizations like Financial Times, Dow Jones, RBC, Omron, Sumitomo, and helped Panasonic launch new products into global markets. But more importantly, he's helped over 300 consultants from around the world. Diehards, we got to find out what makes this guy tick. Please help me welcome the great Michael Sapersky. And hey, I know I mispronounced Sumitomo, and I apologize.
Yeah, yeah. It's Sumitomo, but you weren't that far off.
Okay, cool.
We're glad you're here, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah.
Pleasure. Yeah, really excited to be with you today.
For those of you who cannot see, Michael and I both attend the same barbershop. And if you're listening today, it's a pleasure to talk to somebody who understands what it's like not have to comb his hair in the morning.
Well, it's aerodynamic, right? You know, we have less friction in life.
Exactly.
So how did you become the consultant of consultants?
Yeah, we want to know.
So we're going back now 19, almost 20 years. Really, my first business out of high school was a consulting type of company. I mean, it was web design and development. I started that company with my cousin, Sam. We remain business partners to this day. And we didn't really know it at that time, but you know, we were providing advice and recommendations and ideas around strategy to different companies that we were working with. Fast forward, you know, many years after that, we continued to build different businesses that were all consulting businesses. Our second real company together was called Kanke Culture. The first one was Fingertip Media, but Kanke Culture, Kanke is a Japanese word for relationship, so relationship culture essentially. And we were doing a lot of branding and visual design for organizations. That took me over to Japan and opened up a branch office for our company there. So during that time, you know, we were running consulting companies. And what I realized is that there was a lot of other people out there who wanted to get into consulting, but you know, didn't really understand or didn't know what the best path was. And so we just started sharing our experiences online. Our first business that was an online, strictly business, before Consulting Success, it was called Business Consulting Buzz. We couldn't find a better name than that. But really, it just started as a place to share like stories from the trenches, what was working and what wasn't working. And that took off. There was no monetization plan behind it. It wasn't a business per se.
So when you talk to other consultants who are certain that they know everything, that's why they're consultants, correct?
So our clients are people who are experts in their area. So mm-hmm. They're not coming to us for help with their expertise. They're already experts in whether it's medical or management or design or, you know, chemicals or food and beverage. That's their expertise. We're not going to teach them anything about that they don't already know. But what they lack is a foundation around how to actually grow a consulting business. So how do you get real clarity on, you know, who your ideal clients are? How do you develop a message that's going to resonate and get the attention and interest of your ideal clients? How do you take all of those years of, you know, skills that you've developed and experience and expertise and really package it and position it and place value on it in a way that is going to work for you in the marketplace? And then how do you actually market your service offerings and expertise? So that's the area that we really help them with.
At some point though, don't they have to be a salesperson?
Everyone has to be a salesperson.
No, I mean, you can tout your crap all you want and you can tout your expertise all you want, because I don't want to downplay somebody's 25 years of building their amazing expertise. But if you're trying to attract the client, you have to be able to transfer your message so that the other person gets it and wants to be part of what you know.
100%. I mean, that's a bit one of the biggest challenges that people face. It's like restaurants that open up and they think just because we have a good location that we're going to be able to survive, and it doesn't work that way. So you can have a lot of skills and expertise as a consultant. You may have worked as a, you know, a VP or an executive at a very large multi-billion-dollar organization, but that just by itself doesn't guarantee success. And so getting out there and making sure that you're visible in the marketplace, right? You go from invisible to visible. You go from unknown to becoming known. And then learning how to engage in meaningful sales conversations is critical.
So do you have strategies for that?
Yeah, what do you do? How do you engage? I'm a consultant. I know everything I need to know about the food service business. How do I go out and engage a restaurant chain owner into buying my services?
Yeah, well, the first thing would be to get really clear on who's the actual ideal client.
I know who the client is. I've already pegged him. Now I sit down with him or her, and I want to talk to him.
But how'd you get that meeting? Back up.
I think that's a really good question there, right? Like back up, because before even having the conversation, a lot of people struggle with actually getting the conversation, right? Getting in front of that ideal client. And so there's many different options or kind of paths that people can take. One, obviously, that a lot of people use these days is creating very relevant content, but not just putting content out there, really making sure that your ideal clients are seeing that content that is going to be relevant to them. So, for example, Jeffrey, if you've identified owners of restaurant chains, one thing that you could do would be to connect with them, first of all, on LinkedIn, not through, not trying to do any kind of sales, but just getting a connection, right, starting to build that relationship. Number two, you could send them something of value, right? Something that's going to really demonstrate not just your expertise, but that hits on a pain point or problem that they're having that you know that they're going to resonate with. Then, of course, follow up with a phone call, right? You know this more better than many other people, but the phone is still a very powerful channel or kind of tool that can be used, and not enough people use it. But then continuing to nurture that relationship until that person wants to actually have that conversation with you.
So I want to go back, because you just said, okay, follow up with value, and this is us. So obviously, like, we are very value driven and believe in value, but every guest that seems to come on here is always saying, like, oh, well, you got to send them value, and you got to send them value. And now in today's world, with everybody sending something, how do you get your thing seen?
Well, first, it needs to be good. I think that's a big challenge, that just because there's so much noise out in the marketplace, that just putting something out there isn't good enough anymore. It needs to be something that truly is valuable. And it has to be real. I find too many people try and focus on the short-term sale. Like they're looking at opportunities and people as transactions. And that's a big mistake, because especially when you're in the consulting business, as with many other businesses, it's all about long-term relationships and value. So really caring, genuine approach, looking for ways that you can add the most value and putting out like really good. So if we're talking about content, putting out really good content that cuts through the clutter, you know, don't hire some firm that's just going to write an article for you and put out content because some guru told you that you need to put out content. I mean, really create something that is going to get the attention and interest of your ideal clients. But when they consume that, they go like, wow, this guy or girl like really knows what they're talking about. There's some things in here, opinions and ideas that I didn't know before or that I really appreciate. And that now is going to make them feel much closer to you than they would have, you know, otherwise. And that also helps to differentiate you from the competition.
So diehards, listen up. Your value has to be accepted by your potential customer in order to be perceived as value. If you think it's value and the other person does not perceive it as value, it's not worth jack shit. But if you have something that the other person is genuinely concerned about or interested in, they're going to read it and value you as a result of sending it to them.
I look at it as there's a share test. Would this person want to share it with their boss? Would this person want to share it with their, you know, best colleague, best friend who's their colleague? And if they would, then it's probably valuable.
I don't. I share stuff very reluctantly, but I do share stuff.
Well, and Jeffrey, what you just mentioned there before, I mean, both of you are making really good points. I see this all the time, you know, with consultants come in and think I'm going to create content, but without really thinking about what does your ideal client care about? So the language that you might be using to describe what you're talking, you know, what you're doing or the area that you're in might be very different language, might not hit on the actual pain points and desires that your ideal client has. So being open enough to go out and first have some conversations to learn about what is the language that my ideal clients are actually using? What are the real challenges that they're facing? What are their true desires, right? What are they running up against? Once you really understand that, now you can start to create communications and content that differentiates yourself and really, you know, goes right to them, whereas a lot of other people just put out fluff.
Do you think that people struggle with identifying their ideal client?
A lot of people do. Yeah, and a lot of people go far too broad.
I think you should rename it, not your ideal client. I think you should name it as a client who has the potential to give you money.
Jack?
Yeah.
Joe
your
Money.
Jack client.
Joe Money.
Joe Money.
All right,
Joe and Joe Money.
Yeah. So how do you identify your ideal client then? What's your strategy for that?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different components or variables, right, when you want to think about your ideal client. One is actually reaching decision makers, right? So a big mistake that many people make is they go out and have conversations, but they're talking to people who don't actually have the ability to make a decision. And that creates a lot of frustration and wastes a lot of time. So one is true decision maker. Number two is, do they actually have a real pain point, right? So is there really something that they're going to, that they're hungry to solve? Do they have the ability to make an investment, right, at the level that you're looking for? So if you're targeting very small organizations, but you're ultimately trying to land six-figure contracts, it's probably not going to work out in the way that you want, right? So making sure that, and then the other part of it too is, this is a big one for people that are getting started, is where do you have the greatest leverage? So if you're entering a brand new market, but you don't have a lot of track record, skills or expertise to back that up, results and proof to show that you've helped others in similar situations before, it's not that you can't make it work, but you're going to face a bit more of an uphill battle. It's going to take more time to educate them. But if you can show them, go back to Jeffrey's food service or type of companies, if you can say, yeah, you know, I've worked for 25 years in food service, or I've spent 10 years and we've created X millions of dollars in new growth and revenue, or we've been able to cut down turnover and so on and so on. If you have real results that you've already kind of created in that domain, that now is definitely a point of leverage for you and something that you should consider when you're targeting who your ideal client is.
I think you also need somebody that can go online and post something that says, Michael, put cash in my register, and that's what I really cared about. I
mean, comes back to exactly what I mentioned.
And it may not always be
the ability to invest.
It may not always be a pain point. It may be a value point for something that they're looking to grow to.
100%,
I think that that consultants come in, and you know, the old expression is they shit all over your birthday cake and then leave. The challenge for a real consultant is, will you implement? You know, can you put words into action or words into whatever they're looking at for, and mm-hmm. and make the plan be achievable? But there's one thing that you talked about that has been overlooked, and I want to go back to it and bang it because I think it's the most important part of this whole process. Pick up the fucking phone. Because at some point you can have all the value in the world. If you haven't phoned this other person to make a conversation with them, you have nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Michael's a really smart guy. I wish you would call me. And people don't. For some reason they think, oh, I just sent you that column and I was wondering how you felt about it. If we could, no, dude, phone.
Do you see call reluctance in the work you do?
Well, 100%. Yeah, it's huge. It's massive. You know, one of the biggest reasons is when people are transitioning from, you're in the corporate world. The corporate world is not about you, right? I mean, it's always meant to be about the organization. And so you don't need to necessarily go out. And of course, you're vying to climb up that ladder. But everything that you do is about the product or the service and the company, not about what you specifically are offering. So when you become a consultant, you're in your own world and you have to sell yourself, right? You have to promote what you have. That's something that you're not used to doing. And And you're meant to feel, you know, you're used to feeling that's something that you shouldn't be doing. So it's very uncomfortable for a lot of people to promote themselves, to pick up the phone, because it seems like it's a salesy, hardcore tactic. And what people, I think, you know, they're not often comfortable with at the beginning is understanding that if you really care about those that you want to provide value or a result for, then it's your obligation, you know, your responsibility to do everything you can to at least let them know that you exist, that you may be able to help them. You're not twisting their arm. You're not forcing them to buy from you. But if they have a problem where they want to, you know, reach the next level and you're someone that can help them to do that, at least, you know, get in front of them, pick up the phone, send emails, do whatever you need to do to let them know that you exist, that you're there to help them whenever they want, whenever they're interested. And by doing that, you create a lot more opportunities than if you don't.
Hello, everybody. This is Jake Stenziano, host of Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast, here with my co-host, the multifamily mentor, Mr. Gino Barbaro.
The Wheelbarrow Profits Podcast catalogs our journey to becoming financially free through multifamily real estate investing.
Gang, each week we interview a guest specifically chosen for their expertise in and around multifamily real estate.
We talk you through our entire process, every victory and every misstep and everything that we've learned along the way.
What does that look like? Buy right, manage right, and finance right.
The audio podcast is available wherever fine podcasts are found.
Or check us out on our YouTube page where you'll find tons of other great content.
I have one more thing that I want to add. If you're a consultant out there and you're looking to be able to get involved with a company and earn a fee, which I did for 10 years, by the way, and the one thing I didn't like about consulting is that there's no end to it. But if you are on the phone with someone and they are not the CEO of the company, there is one question that you absolutely have to ask. And the question is, who do you work with to be able to make this happen inside your company?
Mm-hmm.
Because who do you work with may identify the decision maker without actually asking, are you the decision maker?
Yeah, we have a slight shift in that language. We often use, you know, what does the decision-making process look like in your organization?
Mm-hmm.
Or,
mm-hmm.
you know, how do you approach decisions like this within your organization? But exactly to the same point that you're mentioning.
Yeah, I would get to how is the decision made after I find out who do you work with?
Yeah.
Because I think that I'm going to get a name,
right?
I work with the director of the director. You didn't tell me that before,
right? And it helps to uncover a lot of potential objections, right? That might come up that otherwise you wouldn't know. And I think that's as part of the sales cycle, a big challenge that a lot of people face is that you know they're not dealing with those objections early on, and they didn't know that there was three other people involved, or that actually it's a different department that makes that decision, or that they have some other priority in their organization right now that they're working on and they're not. Like I just, before jumping on with both of you, I was talking to a client in the UK who had a great conversation, a workshop with one of their clients, but you know didn't start to plant the seed around objections and what potential objections there are. And so then when they did actually sit down with their client after giving the workshop, they found out that they have other priorities. And even though they can see that good things can happen from what this consultant is offering, they have other priorities they didn't first identify. And so now that conversation has become a little bit more challenging. But that's the opportunity for everyone, is to have a really deep, meaningful conversation where you start exploring what some of those objections might be.
I want to give you a specific example. You say, who do you work with? And the guy says, well, we work with the marketing department. I said, well, how does that work? Well, they have a budget and they give us, you know, X amount of dollars in the budget, but they've spent it all this year. Now, what have I just found out by asking that one little question? And then I'm going to say, well, okay, help me with one thing. Who makes that budget? Because I don't want to talk to the person that spends a budget. I want to talk to the person that makes the budget. That's my person.
What you just said there, I think that those few words of how does that work? Mm-hmm. That to me is just, if not more important than the first question. And I think that's where a lot of people miss, is they don't dig deep enough. They don't peel the layers of the onion. They say, okay, who makes the decision in your organization? Oh, the marketing department does. Okay, great. Well, I guess we'll talk like in 2 weeks from now. And they leave it at that. They don't dig down.
Yeah.
By just asking that additional question, that's where like the real value is. And I think everyone listening should look at the conversations that you're having and ask yourself, could you dig deep? How can you ask further questions to really understand what's going on?
The object of the game is not to drop your line in the water. The object of the game is to catch the fish. And 5% of the fishermen catch 95% of the fish. and keep that in mind as you're looking for those answers. I think the people on the, if you're talking to a person in management or leadership, they want to talk. They're not going to clam up with you because they want to talk because they're looking for answers.
Well, if they feel like you can help them, they definitely want to talk.
Right. They want to get that next project done. They want to do the. They want to acquire that one thing that they're looking to acquire or get more information about productivity or profitability. And if you perceivably have that answer, they're going to want to engage you at a deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to switch gears to proposals because a lot of our diehards send out proposals after their meeting. Mm-hmm. And you're known to help consultants improve their proposals. What are some of the ways in which anyone selling falls short on their proposal and how can we all improve in that area?
Well, number one, they send proposals far too early. They use proposals. So a proposal should not be used to win business. Right, a proposal is really to formalize the conversation that you've had with a buyer. If you're using your proposal to actually try and win your business, you're using it as a marketing tool for yourself. Then you're going to probably be disappointed because that's not the purpose of it. So many times consultants will find that they'll have a good meeting with a prospective client. That prospective client will say, "Yeah, send me a proposal. Let me kind of see what you have." And they'll go, "Okay, great." And they'll get all excited, spend time putting something together, right? Send it over. And then silence, nothing, right? And they're chasing their, "What's going on? Why didn't they get back to me? What did I do wrong? Did I say the wrong thing?" And they're doubting themselves and creating all these issues around self-esteem and lack of confidence. And it's a bad dynamic. You can stop that, right? You can stop that by asking some of the questions that we talked about before around like, how does this actually work in your organization? Is this a priority for you right now? What happens if you don't do this right now? What's the benefit you do this now? So that's why the sales conversation is so critical, to have a really meaningful sales conversation before you get to the proposal. And only when you're clear that the buyer is serious about moving forward and they've told you, this is a priority for us. We really want to do this. Then you can say, okay, fantastic. I'll put together a proposal, send you a few options of how we can maybe work together, send that over and make sure you have a time scheduled. This is so key. Make sure you have a day and time scheduled to review that proposal together with the buyer. Because far too many people waste time in the sales cycle by sending a proposal and then having to play tag to try and, telephone tag with that buyer to set a time to review the proposal. And that's where a lot of time is wasted. So always set a day and time to review it together.
And the proposal takes time. I can tell you that I win 98% of every proposal I send out because I send it when I know they're buying and I send it with one other document attached to the email.
Where to send the money?
The invoice.
Right.
Yeah.
So I sort of skip the proposal stage. I'll outline things on email, and then I send the agreement and the invoice together when they're ready to move forward. What do you think of that?
Think of sending the proposal.
Why do they need a proposal?
No, a lot of people don't. I actually, on our podcast, we recently had Subir Chowdhury on, who he shared the story of how he won a $60 million client engagement with no proposal. So you don't need a proposal. We had another consultant on from the UK not too long ago on our podcast. He doesn't do proposals. So is a proposal a requirement? 100% not, because there's cases of people that don't use them. But in many areas, right, to protect yourself, to make sure you have the legal grounds covered and to ensure that you're setting the right expectations, a proposal is important. But it's certainly not a requirement. And I think this is the big thing, is that a lot of people use the proposal, right? They kind of think about it as, okay, the proposal is going to win the business. But you don't need to have a proposal to win the business. The business should already be won before you send the proposal.
If someone asks me for something in writing, I say, is it possible for us to first set up a Zoom meeting with your CEO?
Mm-hmm.
And then that way I have a shot at convincing him or her that this is the best thing for them, and then it becomes a fait accompli rather than a shot in the dark.
And so when someone says, I think the big concern people have is if I push back on that, right, by saying let's first jump on a Zoom meeting, people are worried they're going to lose the business and lose the opportunity. But what we always see, and just observation, is that if a prospective client is going to jump ship when you push back a little bit, or when you suggest jumping on a Zoom call, they're not going to be a client, or they're
right,
not going to be
exactly
a good client.
Exactly.
Yeah, don't need that right away. Just send the proposal, like douchebag. I'm not going to send a proposal and then try to find you.
Yeah,
I want to find you and find out if you're interested in what I have to offer. And if you are, I'll send you 50 proposals.
So let's go back to the person who does it all right, sends the proposal at the right time, has the follow-up meeting scheduled, and then the day comes for that follow-up meeting and the prospect doesn't show.
Yeah.
And now they're in a game of telephone tag or email tag. When is too many times to keep following up? What's the best way to get their attention back? What do you recommend?
Well, so the one way to avoid this, one of our clients many years ago started doing this and thought it was a great approach, which is they don't send the proposal. They, similar to what kind of Jeffrey mentioned, the proposal is actually delivered on a Zoom call. So at that time it was maybe GoToMeeting or some other technology, but it's let's jump on and review this together. And so the client isn't receiving a proposal to just sit on.
Mm-hmm.
They need to jump on a call. And that's just another micro commitment, right? Another small step that moves them towards feeling more comfortable and building that relationship. And that now has worked very well for many of our clients. But the other thing too, and so back to your question, how often should you follow up and for how long? It's part of this depends on how busy your business is, right? If you have a lot of opportunities, if one person doesn't move forward, but you have plenty more lined up, then you're not going to spend very much time trying to chase that person. If you're earlier stage in your business, you're probably more likely to want to continue chasing them. But the big thing that I always, share with clients is you don't want to appear as needy, right? If you're chasing them down and just keep ringing, hey, did you get a proposal? Like, what's happening? That shows that's not a place of authority. And so you should be always positioning yourself as an authority. Clearly, if something's going on, if you've left messages, you've sent emails, you've sent a text, you're not hearing back, then they're probably not ready to move forward. And my observation is that if you try and force someone to move forward with something that they might not want to do right now, it's probably not going to be a successful project. Now, that doesn't mean that you neglect them and that you give up too early because you sent it, you didn't hear back once or twice and you're done. No, I think there's a lot more room to follow up. But you can also follow up in a very respectful and kind of authority type of approach, which is stop talking about the proposal. Like, focus on the human being and say, and check in. How are you doing? Is everything okay? And if you still don't hear back, maybe they're not ready to move forward right now. Okay, nurture them. Send them other valuable content. Keep checking in. How are things going? Hope you're doing well. They know that you sent the proposal, right? They know that they either still need your help or they don't need your help. They'll appreciate you for not hounding them and rather just treating them like actual human being. And when they're ready to do something, they'll let you know.
I have found the one tip that no one has the balls to use is don't put a price in your proposal.
Mm.
And if they read the proposal, they're going to look for the price and call you up and go, "What?
Where's the price?
There's no price in here." That's correct. I was hoping that you would read the proposal and see that there was no price and talk to me, because that usually indicates pretty deep interest. Is that fair to say, Mr. Jones? But you have to have balls. Most people, they're arguing with their coworkers what the price should be, when in fact the price doesn't matter to most people if the help is genuine.
One variation of that that we've seen used successfully over the years is a draft proposal. So you go in exactly, you mentioned everything in there, right? What you believe is what the client wants based on your conversations. You don't have a price because there might still be some information missing. And so rather than going in and assuming some things that you don't know, the draft proposal, you go in, you review with the client, and you confirm that everything that is in there is what they actually want. And the nice thing about doing this live on a Zoom call or in person is you can actually make edits to the proposal live together. And then you're delivering to the client something that they told you they want. And then when you know that and you're very clear in that conversation, because you've now confirmed the value for the client and the potential ROI for them, now you can really set up pricing that is going to match and align with that value.
I agree.
I love it. That's awesome.
We're in alignment, actually. It's the bald guys think alike or something. I don't know what the hell it is. But
we got something going, Jeffrey.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So tell us about your podcast.
Yeah.
Sure. So the Consulting Success Podcast is a podcast where we feature, we've had Jeffrey on, wonderful consultants and people who are experts in their area, really to share their journey, their story, exploring kind of how they started out, how they got to where they are today, lessons learned along the way. with the goal of helping, you know, others in their journey. And so we feature successful people, and you know, we put out one a week right now. It's been growing, and we've been doing it for quite some time, and we really enjoy it. I mean, I love having these kind of interactions, and I think that the part that I appreciate the most is all the emails and feedback that we get from listeners saying, hey, you know, really enjoyed that you had that guest. And actually, we get a lot of emails from guests saying, I don't know if you've heard this before or not, but I've got a whole bunch of LinkedIn, you know, messages from people saying how much they enjoyed the podcast and what I shared. So for us, the podcast is just, it's a great aspect of our business. It's one that I really enjoy because it's nice to learn what's working for others and hear their stories.
Another fantastic episode of Sell or Die is now in the books.
Let's let the listener be the judge of that.
You can be. Subscribe. Rate and review our show today. In fact, right now.
Or if that sounds too complicated, tell a friend.
Tell both your friends.
Because if you're not selling,
you're dying.
We're leaving.
Au revoir.
Shalom.
This has been a presentation of the Sell or Die Network. For more podcasts that you can take out into the street and turn into money, visit sellordienetwork.com.